All right, let's look at the at Solomon's Song, chapter 6, verse 12. And the subject this morning is the chariots of Amminadab. The chariots of Amminadab. Roll call again this morning is always getting the titles. So what you preaching on? What's the title this morning? I said, the chariots of Amminadab. He said, let's go over that real slow. Verse number 12, or ever I was aware, my soul made me like the chariots of Amminadab. That word to be divided is two words, and it can be divided and is so by some, Amminadab. I'm fairly settled on the speaker here. Those of you who have the Amplified Bible, the Amplified Bible, in the way I've been running this series of studies, we differ. They have the speaker sometimes, the character of the speaker quite differently than what I see it. And I think I'm more consistent with the orthodoxy of the commentaries and expositions than the Amplified is. But they have this as being the words of the Shulamite, the maiden. But I think it would break the continuity here. He's speaking, of course, from verse 9, it's clear, from verse 4 all the way down. Verse 9, my dove, my undefiled, is but one. And she's the only one of her mother. That's clearly the shepherd king speaking there, commending the maid, the spouse, the Shulamite. And then in the latter part of that verse, beginning about the middle part, says the daughters saw her and the blessed, and blessed her, yea, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. Here he's referring back to the retinue, to the attendants in the court, which he speaks of in verse number 8. Says there are three score queens and four score concubines and virgins without number. This is just a great attendance or retinue of in the king's court there that seems to be alluded to here. And then when he picks it up here in verse number 9, as I tried to explain to you before, in verse number 10, the thought division should not be there, and I did not divide it. It says the daughters saw her and blessed her, yea, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her, saying, remember, I believe we should supply that, they're saying, who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fairest among clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners? And then he picks up again, I went down into the gardens of nuts to see the fruits of the valley, and to see whether the vine flourished and the pomegranates budded. Then he's still speaking. He says, or ever I was aware, my soul made me like the chariots of Amminadab. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon thee. What will ye see in the Shulamite? As it were, the company of two armies. And there again, it appears that the retinue picks up. The voice of the retinue comes through in verse 13, saying, return, return, O Shulamite. And then he seems to ask this question, what will ye see in the Shulamite? And this seems to be their answer, as it were, the company of two armies. But verse 12 is what we want to look at this morning. And try to dig something out here. Shepherd King, of course,
Christ,
who continues to speak of his
visit with his church, his people, which is represented by the Shulamite.
And this is a difficult text to me. It was to me very difficult. I don't even think I cleaned it up. My desk, which is a huge desk that I found a few years back that suited me well, it just about takes up half that study, that little study up there. But sometimes I have to have a lot of room. And I got stuff spread out all over. I got expositions and commentaries. And I warned Patsy, don't touch anything. She wants to clean that study up, you know. And it does. It gets filthy and it gets dusty and cluttered up. But if you bother anything, I don't know where I am. And I've got that stuff all over the desk. I must have three or four commentaries and expositions scattered out. And I was trying to work through this thing. And that's aside several things I took off the shelf and looked at them right quickly and put them back. But it's difficult. Here's some translations I want to share with you of verse 11 and 12. The New American Standard Bible. The New American Standard. I'm not talking about the Revised Standard Version. I may have a copy of that thing somewhere, just for reference back in my study there. But it's probably one of the worst translations ever published by man. But the New American Standard is a pretty good translation. I'm a King James person. I don't believe you need to move out of this old King James Bible. As Peter Ruckman once said, and he was a word authority, that is Hebrew and Greek, and he says what we need to do is learn how to read the King's English. It's pretty clear. Just read the King's English. But here's the New American Standard. It says, I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranates had bloomed. Before I was aware, this is verse number 12, before I was aware, my soul set me over the chariots of my noble people. Here's another translation. I went down to the nut orchard to see what was sprouting in the valley, to see if the vines were budding and the pomegranate trees were in flower. Before I knew, my desire had hurled me on the chariots of my people as their prince. This opens up a little bit more, each one of these translations. Here's another one. I went down to the grove of nut trees to look at the new growth in the valley, to see if the vines had budded or the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I realized it, my desire set me among the royal chariots of my people.
And they're doing this with one word here, the word Amenadab. And look at that word. I said it's two words, two Hebrew words. You break them down, and we find the meaning of the first word is fairly easy, no problem, because we have it in the book of Hosea. Hosea chapter 1, look at it. Hosea chapter 1 and verse number 9. Then said God, call his name, and this is the first son of Gomer, the harlot wife of Hosea. Then said God, call his name Lo-Ammi, and the Cambridge. How many of you have the Cambridge King James Bible? Most of you, I think, have picked up on it. The Cambridge has a marginal note there. Give you a literal rendering. This word means not my people. Not my people. For ye, and well, he goes on and tells you what it means. For ye are not my people.
And I will not be your God. Down in verse number 1 of chapter 2. Say unto your brethren, am I
my people?
And to your sister, Rohamah. Of course, you got a marginal note on that also. But we're not interested in that at this time. But the word here, am I, is clearly
a Hebrew word which means my people. My people. So that that brings us some light on the subject over here in our study. The word nadib, N-A-D-I-B, nadib, means willing. That's a Hebrew word which means willing. You have it in Psalm 110, verse 3. Thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power. Sometimes just a little simple word study. Just run, you know, a few references and compare a few scriptures will open something up to you in just an enormous way, most blessed way. I've got an Nelson Wide Margin Bible, and it has a marginal note giving a literal rendering of this verse in the song. And in my margin, in my Nelson margin, it says, set me on the chariots of my willing people. See how it opens up there? In other words, he's elated. He's overwhelmed. He goes down and visits his church, his people. Such a thrill to him to be in the midst of his people. And this makes me always somewhat grieved when his people are not as thrilled to be in his presence. And when his church meets, he's here. This is the Lord's day. This is the Lord's assembly. We're here to honor and glorify the Lord, our blessed Redeemer, our glorious Redeemer. He comes into the midst of the church. He's overwhelmed with his people's presence. Why shouldn't we be with his presence? And so that's the picture we have here. That's what we see in this one little verse here. Or ever I was aware, my soul made me like the chariots of Amminadab. That is, I was overwhelmed. And I was just flung onto the chariots of my willing people. To set upon the chariots of my willing people. The language is indicative here of some swift-driven chariots at the time of Solomon. Maybe someone like Jehu. I thought about Jehu. Look over here in 2 Kings chapter 9. 2 Kings 9. You know, we have, throughout the Bible, we have characters like Jehu and Joab. I mean, they were rough, rugged, I mean, just tough fellas, you know, bloodthirsty, wicked as they could be, but you always find some admiration about these fellas. Joab, you have to admire Joab. He was a trooper. He was a general. He knew how to win wars. He knew how to fight battles. And God used those men. You don't think God didn't use those men? God used those men. It's like he used Jehu to accomplish his deed upon Ahab and Jezebel. But here we have Jehu. And in verse number, I'm going to begin in verse number 16. Save a lot of reading here. Reading down through verse 20. Now he's on, his purpose here is to accomplish the purpose of God. I mean, his mission is to accomplish the purpose of God. He's been anointed king. Temporary, but he's been anointed king. And to accomplish what Elijah, the preacher, the prophet, had predicted would happen to the house of Ahab and to Jezebel. Now, it's been a long time coming, but payday someday. It showed up, and God did exactly what he said he was going to do with them through the prophet Elijah. And so here the time of payoff comes, and Jehu has been appointed to do this. And it says, and Jehu rode in a chariot and went to Jezreel, for Joram lay there, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, was come down to see Joram. And there stood a watchman on the tower in Jezreel, and he spied the coming of Jehu as he came, and said, I see a company. And Joram said, take an horseman and send to meet him, and let him say, is it peace? So there went out one on horseback to meet him, and said, thus saith the king. This is his question to Jehu. Thus saith the king, is it peace? And Jehu said, what hast thou to do with peace? Turn thee behind me. That's what he's telling this guy. He says, if you don't want some of this, you better get behind me and follow me. He says he goes on and says, and the watchman told, saying, the messenger came to them, but he cometh not again. Then he sent out a second horse on horseback, which came to them and said, thus saith the king, is it peace? And Jehu answered, what hast thou to do with peace? Turn thee behind me. And the watchman told, saying, he came even unto them and cometh not again. And the driving is like the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi, for he driveth furiously. And I've got a marginal note there. Driving like a madman. I mean, he's coming fast. And so I think probably there was some great pride in those days taken concerning the ability to drive those chariots. Of course, they had the chariot races, we know, in ancient times, and it was a great sporting event. But there seems to be an idea of swiftness here connected with the language in this text. And that's also important if we understand what the message is in the text for us. And I think from what we have, we learn at least this. There's many things I know that we can learn here that someone else could probably get into. But this is what I got out of it. When our Lord Jesus Christ is stirred up for his church, when he's stirred up for his people, when there's a need, when Christ is stirred up, saying in respect to protection or preservation or provision for his church, he acts presently. He moves swiftly. He's instant upon whatever the need is. He doesn't hesitate. He doesn't tarry. He comes when the need arises. He's always there. That not only applies to the church as a whole, it applies to his people individually. You can expect that. So there's a couple of things here, three things here I want us to consider in developing the message this morning. I want us to consider, first of all, what it was that set him on this swift return to his church. What was it? It's in the text here. What was it that set him on this swift return to his church?
Well, it certainly has nothing to do with the church or with the church on her part, as far as she is in herself. You know, here in the text, you know, she's still struggling under this backslidden state. This thing starts back in chapter 5 when she put him off and she postponed his visit and she made excuses. You remember that, don't you, back in chapter 5? He came knocking, he came for fellowship, he came for communion, and she said, but I'm somewhat preoccupied. I've put off my shoes, I've put off my coat, and it's going to be a lot of trouble for me to get up and make myself ready and to entertain you. And so he put his hand inside the hole of the door and unlatched it and just went away. And we've gone over this time and time again. What's he showing us there? That if he was willing, he could force an entrance. He'd come on in. He could force us to fellowship with him. Have you ever wanted to force anybody to have company with you? Huh? Somebody didn't want to have nothing to do with me. I mean, I certainly wasn't going to force the issue. Isn't that kind of the way human nature is? Well, that's the way Christ is. I mean, it's got to be a willingness on our part, a desire, a yearning for his nearness, his presence in our midst. And so she's still, I think, through chapter 6, this struggle continues to go on. Matter of fact, down here in verse number 13, here's this appeal to return. Return, return, O Shunammite. Of course, we know this is by the attendants. She's struggling, I say, somewhat yet with a backslidden condition. So, we can't find anything really in her that stirs him up so. It wasn't her worthiness. So, the church militant, that's the church as it is in this world, that's as we are now, I can't see anything in us worthy of him being stirred up about, can you? I look at myself to begin with, and I search in here before I search anywhere else, and I don't see anything in this old carnal creature standing before you that would stir him up for me. Sort of like Jacob, he sort of gives the pattern over there, and somewhat of an understanding in Genesis 32 when the Lord visited him at Bethel, and he made this statement. He thought, who am I? He said, Lord, I'm unworthy. I'm unworthy of the least of thy truth and the least of thy mercies that you would show unto your servant. Unworthy. That's all I see is unworthy. And we have these things all the way through the Scripture. Peter, over in chapter 5 of Luke, Peter, after that great miracle, that mighty display of the omnipotence of Jesus Christ, when that great catch of fish, that miracle of the great draught of fish were caught, and in so much that the nets were breaking, and they filled up two boats and there were still fish. And Peter had just made the statement, we've been fishing all night, there's no fish here. And the Lord said, well, just cast your net on the right side of the boat. And in doubt, he was in doubt, not in faith. Well, even as you say, we're going to prove to you no fish here. So he cast his net and they couldn't hold the fish. What did Peter do? He fell down at the feet of Jesus and said, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, Lord. That was his attitude at a great display of the power of Christ. And that old publican always comes to mind. He fits the attitude of an awakened sinner, a man that knows his condition and state before God. In Luke chapter 18, after all the boasting and bragging, the pride-filled Pharisee displayed there, all he could do was smite upon his breast and say, "Lord, have mercy upon me, the sinner." The sinner. And so it wasn't her worthiness that stirred him up so. All believers in and of themselves feel the same as Jacob did, same as Peter did, the same as Isaiah. Now there's another Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6. Woe is me. Woe is me. No, it's in the text. I tell you, it's right here in the text. What moved him is clearly stated. He says, "Or ever I was aware, my soul made me." My soul. God in himself is stirred up for his people. Christ in himself is stirred up for his people. You don't stir him up. I don't stir him up. He stirred himself up. If he waited on you and I to be stirred up, he'd never be stirred up. Did you realize that? Maybe we can swallow enough self-righteousness this morning to be honest with ourselves. Be honest with this text. No, no, no. He stirred himself up. He stirred himself up. It was his own love, his own affection that he bore for the church, for her. His own love, his own affection that he bears for us, his assembled people, stirs himself up. His soul is stirred up within him and causes himself to come swiftly and to light in the midst of his church and to manifest his presence unto us. Look at Psalm 106. Psalm 106, beginning there with verse number 1. Praise ye the Lord. Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he's good. For his mercy endureth forever. Who can utter the mighty acts of the Lord? Who can show forth all his praise? Blessed are they that keep judgment, and he that doeth righteousness at all times. Remember me, O Lord, with the favor that thou bearest, that thou favorest thy people with. O visit me with thy great salvation, that I may see the good of thy chosen, that I may rejoice in the gladness of thy nation, that I may glory in thine inheritance. Now here's confession. We have sinned. We have sinned. Well, if we could ever get down to confession. I mean confessing, first of all, owning it in ourselves and not going to a confessional booth and confessing that some fella don't know what confession is in the first place and needs all the confession that he can muster for his own self. I'm talking about confessing to Christ, to God, whom we have offended. We have sinned with our fathers. We have committed iniquity. We have done wickedly. All this we have done this, not they. He's not looking back through history then, he said, they have sinned. They have committed iniquity. They have committed all sorts of wickedness. No, he said, we did it. Our fathers understood not thy wonders in Egypt. They remember not the multitude of thy mercies, but provoked him at, or literally provoked you
at the sea, even the Red Sea. Now look at verse 8. Nevertheless, he saved them. Why? Huh? For his name's sake. If he saved you, who'd he save you for? For your sake? He saved you for mom and daddy's sake? Huh? And why he did it? A lot of times when we're appealing to the Lord, I'm talking about his parents or his people appealing to the Lord for the salvation of our children or others. Many times it's to get them out of our hair. Lord, they're running me nuts. But I tell you, if he ever saves the one of them, he's not going to save them for your sake. But he's never saved a sinner for the sinner's sake or for anyone else's sake. He's never saved anyone except for his name's sake. He guards his name. He seeks the glory of his name. That's all God is interested in. He's interested in his own glory. Somebody says, well, that's selfish. Well, God can be selfish if he pleases to be selfish. And he is selfish. He's all bound up in himself. And who are you to reply, old man? You don't charge God? Nevertheless, he saved them for his name's sake, that he might make his mighty power to be known. He's interested in himself. Look over here in Psalm 79. Verse number 9. Here's a fellow's crying out, old Asaph, he's in need. He's crying out to the Lord. And he's concerned about the environment around him, especially the religious environment. He said in verse number 1, O God, the heathen are coming to thine inheritance. Thy holy temple have they defiled. They have laid Jerusalem on heaps, and we see that in our own environment religiously today. They've desecrated the name of Christ. They're laying claims upon him who have no right to lay claims upon him. And it disturbed me, and what does you know? It grieves me. He says in verse 9, help us. Help us. We need some help. We're in need of help. We're in trouble. That's our problem. That's our problem. We just don't know how much trouble we're in. We need help. He says, help us, O God of our salvation, for the glory of thy name. And deliver us and purge away our sins. For what? Thy name's sake. Thy name's sake. It's all through here. I mean, I just picked out two or three. It's Psalm 31, Psalm 25, 11, Psalm 23, 3. He leads us in paths of righteousness for what? For why? For his name's sake. All of it's for his sake. That's why he's stirred up here. He's stirred up for his sake. And so he sets himself upon the chariots of his willing people. And so Christ is he's likened to the chariots of the Menadim, in that he bears his people in all of their circumstances. And says, well, I want you to look at the manner here in which his soul was affected. It says it made him like the chariots of Amminadab. That is very, very swift to entertain his people, to set himself upon his people. Very swift. The Lord's quick, you know it? He's swift. Over here in the, well, let me just quote it for you. In the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about the second coming of the Lord Jesus. When he comes again, he says he's coming in a moment. And it seemed like Paul said, no, that's not quick enough. He said, no, in the twinkling of an eye. That's quicker than a blink. Did you realize that? You can't hardly see a blink. I mean, it's gone. It's there and it's gone. You can't see a twinkle. It's almost impossible to see a twinkle. That's how quick the Lord's coming. And that's how speedy He is to come to your need, to visit you. Even sometimes when you don't want His visitation, He'll be there. Very quick, very swift. Now look at Psalm 46 in verse number 1 through 5. I love this psalm. This is a psalm of I call it the Psalm of the Reformation. This is a psalm that Luther based his hymn on that we sing so often, Mighty Fortress is Our God. Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength. What does it say there? A what? A very
present help
in trouble. I mean, just there. Present help in trouble.
Therefore will we not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be hurled into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. He said, there is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God. That's the church, the city of God. That's the New Jerusalem. That's the city that you start referring to in Revelation 21. Ed, it doesn't have need of the sun or the moon. Why? Because Christ is our light. Christ is in the midst of us. Christ gives us light in this dark world that we live in. You see, the world outside of us, it shakes and trembles in fear when things become, begin to get out of order. And brother, this is disorder here when he talks about the earth being removed, the mountain being carried into the midst of the sea. I mean, that'd shake the world all to pieces, but would it bother you, a believer? No, sir. I mean, people look at this outside of us and they think about the end of time, the collapse of the world, the destruction of the world as we know it. Does that bother you? It doesn't bother me. Why? Because I'm in the midst of God. He's in the midst of His church. We have God's presence instantly and always. Goes on and says, God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved, though all these other things be knocked out of order. She shall not be moved. Why? God shall help her. How quick? And that right early. In the Hebrew, in the margin, here says, when the morning appears. Just like when the dawn breaks. In the midst of trouble, God's there. That's how quick, how present He is. Look over here at Daniel chapter 5 right quickly. Daniel 3. Look at verse 14 beginning there. In Daniel 3. I'm breaking into the story here. You need to go back and read it all if you've not been familiarized yourself with it lately. Nebuchadnezzar, he's built this tremendous image, built it to himself, to his own pride, to his own glory, established in the plain. Everybody's supposed to bow down to this thing when the band strikes up. And three fellas didn't do it. And Nebuchadnezzar spake unto these three fellows. He calls them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, named after his false gods. They're three Hebrew children. He says, do ye not serve my gods? Do you not worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if ye be ready, I'm going to give you one more chance. One more opportunity. If you get ready and when the band strikes up and you'll bow down to that image out there, he said, we'll forego this punishment that I've devised for you people. What he'd done, he'd built a huge furnace. And this furnace had been heated enormously so, unbelievably so. And everybody that didn't, anyone that didn't comply to his rules concerning worship, were cast into this furnace of fire, destroyed. And so this is what he's proposing to these fellows. He goes on and said, but if ye worship not, ye shall, in verse 15, he said, ye shall be cast same hour into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is that God? Who is that God? Another fellow asked that over in the book Exodus. Who is the Lord that I should obey him? History's full of monarchs, pride-filled monarchs that in their pride question the existence of God and his power. They're all dead and all destroyed, burning in hell. God's people continue to move. Who is this God, that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful. You know, we don't give the least thought. We're not the least apprehensive or reluctant in this situation. We're going to tell you right up front. We're not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if it's not his, that's what he's saying here, but if it's not his pleasure, his purpose, be it known unto thee. Oh, what a lesson here. Here's a message right here. Be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. That's pretty strong witness, isn't it? Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage, his appearance, was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace one 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. Boy, he was hot, wasn't he? And so they did so. And he commanded the most mighty men, the mighty of all the mighties, the strongest, the robust. He commanded them that they were in his armies to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, their hats, their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took them up and cast them into the furnace. What about that? That's judgment, isn't it? That's God's judgment. Therefore, it said, well, down in verse number 23, and these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astonished and rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said, we did, king. And he said, well, lo, I see four men there. I see four men there. And he says, loose, not bound, but loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Now, what about that? The Lord and some strange way manifested himself to this heathen king, let him know that God was in the furnace with him. And you know, the scripture says over in the book of Amos, I believe it is, that God is a wall of fire about his people. So the wall of fire that God is about his people was mightier than the wall of fire in the furnace which had been heated 7 times.
And it stayed the heat of the fire from these three Hebrew children. Matter of fact, when they delivered them up, the only thing that was burnt off these fellas was a rope that they bound them with. God was a present help in a time of need. He was there.
And that's what he's saying over here to us. But the final thing over here, final thing. I want you to consider in the last few statements here with me the literal translation that I gave you a while ago. The literal translation, remember I said, set me on the chariots of my willing people. Of my willing people. Now look at Psalm 110, verse 3. Psalm 110, verse 3. Here's that text that I quoted a while ago. Thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power. Thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power. Now we believe in free will. You understand what I'm talking about? We believe in free will. We're going to qualify. We believe that God frees the will of his people in conversion, in salvation. And his people become a willing people. A willing people to respond to the call of the gospel. Yeah, they're trying to get folks to respond to something out here that they're unable to until God gives them the ability to do it. I mean, I came willingly to Christ. He didn't force me. I came gladly. I came with joy in my heart. When I received Christ with a willing spirit. I rejoiced to receive Christ. But something had already happened. I've said this before. Understand what I'm saying. This is not fatalism. A man is saved. Let me get this right. How'd I get this? No, that's not it. A man saved. A man, when a person wants to be saved, that's what I want. When a person wants to be saved, desires to be saved, it's indicative that he's already saved. I mean, you're never saved until you want to be saved. But you see, the Lord did something where you want to. Has to do something where you want to. I never cared for these things until the Lord did something. Did something in my soul. Had no desire for these things. I don't come to church because I have to come down here and preach. From the day God converted me and I started attending local assemblies, I did that with a willing heart. I mean, the preacher didn't have to come over and knock on my door, get a hold of my hand, say, it's time to go to church. Didn't have to drag me down there. Even though most of those early churches that I attended were far from what we have here as far as the doctrine is concerned, the truth is concerned. But it's the best thing that I knew possible at that time, and I had a sense that Christ was there somewhere in the presence, and it was the pleasure of the Lord that I assembled, and I just went. It's the idea that, man, this is folks just doing things they don't want to do. I hope you're not here this morning because you just feel like you had to be here. His people are willing. His people are willing. He makes them willing. Paul told those Philippians over there when he wrote to them, he said, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who worketh in you both to will
and to do of His good pleasure. And we do work it out, but it's God working in us from beginning to end. It's always the Lord working in us.
Well, He says here that He set Himself on the chariots of His willing people.
Willing to do what?
Well, give you three quick things here. Willing to depart. Willing to depart or part from sin. That's the first thing God makes a sinner willing to do. To depart from sin. To break from his or her idols. Well, there is a definite change in a sinner when God gets hold of the heart. Over in the book of Hosea, chapter 14, Hosea 14, and verse number 8. This is a good verse, good text here. Ephraim shall say,
he's talking about the day that his people are converted here. He's talking about the conversion of his spiritual Israel all through here. He says, Ephraim shall say, Ephraim, you know, in a state of rebellion, worshiping other gods, and God sent judgment after judgment, but the judgment just didn't break him from his love of other gods. But when God gets hold of the heart, and he's talking about conversion here, Ephraim shall say, what have I to do anymore with idols? That's conversion. That's salvation. When God gets hold of our hearts, he breaks us from worshiping other things. God becomes our God. We become his people. Our loyalty and devotion and allegiance is to Christ alone. It's like those three Hebrews over there. We will not worship your gods, and we will not bow down to your image. And if it ever comes down to it in our society where we're put to the test, you can mark it down, God's people will stand just where the Hebrews did. Thank God we hadn't been put to the test yet, but it may come. And that's what makes me wonder about so many of these people that profess Christ, profess to know God today, that can't pass the small test. Always flunking out before the great exam comes. Little things. Things that are meager and minor keep them from manifesting an allegiance and loyalty to the King. But I know this. When a person's saved, that person's will is delivered. And that person becomes willing to depart from whatever it is that God calls us to depart from. Like Abraham, come out from thy people and away from thy country. All right, Lord, where do you want me to go? Follow me. And there he went. You ought to go and study the life of Abraham. Pastor's reading Genesis 23 this morning. Was it 23 this morning? Want me to read it? He's talking about Abraham when he bought that land over there. He wanted that land to bury his wife Sarah in. Didn't want them to give it to him. They loved him. God had given Abraham favor with those heathen over there, and they loved Abraham. They wanted to give him that piece of ground. He said, no, I'm not going to do it. I won't buy it. It'll be mine. He manifests that principle all the way through his life there. Why? Because he was the father of the faithful. He was setting the standard. He was setting the pattern for God's children to follow. Being full of faith in all things, trusting the Lord, not leaning to the world or trusting the world, leaning to his own understanding, but walking after God. Willing to depart from all things.
not only willing to part with sin, but his people are willing to part with this sinful world and all sinful companions. You believe that? Just like Ruth. We went through the book of Ruth with Brother Conrad recently. Remember Ruth when she left Moab and she was following after her mother-in-law Naomi, also her sister Oprah is Winfrey. Well, you remember that, and how that they got down the road of peace, and Naomi said, go on back to your people and to your gods, to your way of living, your way of worship. I got nothing to offer you. Finally, Oprah went back, didn't she? She turned back. But Ruth clave unto, that's what the Bible says, Ruth clave unto her. And she says, no, said, where you go, I'll go. Your people shall be my people, your God shall be my God. She was converted. She had been converted. She had nothing back there. Everything was before. So it is with every true converted child of God. Everything is before us. Nothing is back there. Leave it, ditch it. And then they're willing to depart finally with their own righteousness. And this is the last thing in this world that a prideful man will give up. An unconverted man will hold on to that righteousness, that self-righteousness, as long as he lives. You cannot pry him loose from it. Only God can break him from it. Only God can make him willing. I think that's the whole episode with Job. Now, you can say what you want to, and I got friends and preachers both sides, but I've held a year that Job wasn't saved until the 42nd chapter of Job. And the last thing he would give up, he gave up all of his wealth, he gave up his children, he gave up his wife, he gave up his health, but he would not relinquish his self-righteousness. That's what the tug of war is over all the way through that book, it appears to me. But he got to the end of it. He said, I've heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. And he said, I repent in dust and ashes.